Accession number 30078, reel 6.
And I wasn't feeling all that happy in the battalion. I could feel a sense among some officers that why have we got a foreign devil still commanding us? On the other hand, there were three extraordinarily nice and good officers who gave me full backing and everything. And in the end, I thought, well, I've done 9 months of it. I think I'm owed leave and everything. I think I'll apply to pull out. I only had a one-year contract. They gave 1 to 3 year contracts, but 1 year contracts went to infantry things. You got a 3 year contract only if you were a specialist in something like arms factory or something. It would take a long time to replace you. So I had my 1 year contract. So after 9 months of it, I thought, well, with travel time and my leave, it'll just take the year completely. So I put in to come home. I came home in 1948. August, I think, just about August 48, with 2 months leave on hand. And that was the end of my Indian Army career.
What had been your own attitude towards Indian independence and partition?
Sad. Very, very sad. British officers, on the whole, was said to be more pro-Muslim than pro-Hindu. I think the reasons given were A, that the Muslims had one god like we did. The Hindus had three crores. I don't know how many that is in English, but it's thousands and thousands and thousands of gods. B, that you could eat with any Muslim. C, you couldn't eat with any Hindu. It depended on their caste. I mean, I was told by my first colonel, Gracie, the very nice one, I want you to go down every evening to the cookhouse and just sit there and let the men talk to you and you talk to them to learn the language. But he said, do not go into the cookhouse and don't let your shadow go across the food or anything like that. Sit outside, because the caste system would have said, oh, that's happened. I think the English felt that was a bit off-putting. It rather made a line between us. And I think the third thing was not a very good reason, but your average big fat bunya sitting in the shop door, you know, big, you would have seen them greasy and that and all that. They didn't look extremely sort of nice types in a way. And you felt more towards your rather smarter Muslim and so on. So I think the English were a little more pro-Muslim, but therefore, some English people thought, well, if they go their own Muslim country, probably it's a good thing. But the English didn't realize that the Mohammedanism was spread right across India, from north to south. And actually, as you know, there are still more Muslims in India than there are in Pakistan. So on the whole, it was considered a stupid idea. And of course, most of us were fed up because our careers were finished early. That's where Pat, I mentioned Sandhurst, when he'd opted, and his father had been very, very wise, because he would have ended like me with just on 12 years service. You could opt to come back, but in the opting to come back, you were selected by your age to start with, what unit you want to go to, and was there a vacancy in that level? And of course there weren't many vacancies, because many wartime officers have stayed on. So not a lot of people came back, and then again some had not been to the staff college in India because of the war. There wasn't time to go. I had a letter from my only same level person from my battalion the other day. He's in Australia. And he said that he got to the British Army. He held three consecutive lieutenant colonel positions, but could not go above because he hadn't been to the staff college. And you see, he'd arrived too old in England to go to the staff college, but couldn't go above lieutenant colonel. And yet he was a most efficient person. You know, they lost a really good high commander purely on a thing like that. So I think on the whole we were all very, very sad. Regulars definitely, because we'd lost our jobs. Since then we've become sadder at what's happening, and the split and the fighting in Kashmir and the two-facedness of Pakistan, which is very two-faced at the moment. And happy for India in a way that it's really got hold of itself and started an increase in the middle classes and booming, and it's going to be one of the boom countries. I'm not sure of the numbers, but I believe when we left, there was something like 67 million who could be classed middle class. It was quite a small group. Now, apparently, there's something like 547 million and spreading fast. So, I mean, for them, good, they've got on. Although still there's poverty in the villages and on the cities in Bombay and that on the streets, there are people sleeping on the pavement still. It's a country of complete and utter opposites.
Would you have considered living on in India?
Then, no, because it wasn't the done thing, I suppose. But now, yes, I would have done it if I'd had more sense. I would have stayed on. I got a very reduced pension in India. Was paid, I think, after 18 years' service. But they said, because we were having our careers disrupted, they brought pension down bit by bit by bit until I think they got down to 10 years' service. And I had just on 12 then, and I think I got £240 a year. So I said, ah, good, I've got beer money anyhow. Well, now that has gone up with increases now to 4,700, which isn't a lot in these days, but it helps. I think if I'd had that much in India, I would have been all right, because with the exchange rates as they are and everything, £4,700 is quite a reasonable amount of rupees. And I could have, this is the wrong thing to say, I could have continued in the Saab way of life, in that I could have had a couple of servants, which makes life a little easier. I'm not necessarily the marrying type. I was 40 when I married, and I think I could have, if necessary, married an Indian quite happily, because there are some bloody good-looking Indians. I know two people, now both dead, unfortunately, who did stay out there, and they were very, very happy. And I don't know if you've seen the TV film Staying On, is it called? Staying On? It's quite some time ago, a series were made. I see, now I'm getting to the stage, I can't even remember the author of that. Staying On, it was an old colonel and his wife who stayed on. And although it ended a little unhappily, it showed that it was quite nice having the old Indian life. Went up into the hills, bought a small place. And one of my officers now, Indian Army Association, has done that. He's gone back at the age of 82 and bought a small place at the edge of the Himalayas. And I had one letter only from him and then heard nothing. He might be dead. Which he said, it's rather nice being back to having somebody look after you and just to be your own master and look around and feel that you're not subject to vast taxes in England and all the rush and bustle of people. I think I probably could have done it. But then on the other hand, I would have missed a bloody good life after it, because I've been everything, done everything and been everywhere. You had more than I've ever given anybody.
Getting on the subject of the Indian Army in general, could you talk a bit about the interrelation between the various religious groups that would be in the army and the caste system as well?
In the army, there were, I think, four regiments only, which are of one religion. The British on the old divide and rule system, which is probably sensible, would have in most battalions, take a grenadier battalion if you like, three companies of Hindus, one company Muslims, and headquarter company, which would be mixed, because the headquarters would be like your signalers, your mortar platoon, all that. They wouldn't necessarily mix the platoon, but they'd have, say, Hindu signalers, Muslim mortars. Both religions ate separately. Each had its own temple. You had the regimental mandir for the Hindus, you had the regimental masjid for the Muslims. Apart from that, the Indian officers' mess, that's the Jemadars, Subedar, Subedar Major, they mixed, they had one mess. But I think they had the different foods served, but they sat together and were like an officer's mess in that state. we mixed freely with them all, but we had to be careful, as I told you earlier, about food with Hindus and not wearing one's shoes in a cookhouse and that sort of thing. Apart from that, in the army, I don't think there was much to worry about. As far as I remember, there was only one mutiny pre this war. That was in 1905, I think. No, 1915. And that was a Maratha regiment in Malaya. And I don't even think that was religious. I think that was bad command somewhere along the line. And we would send out mixed groups of soldiers to religious riots. We did, I mean, there were many religious riots, sort of endemic to India, if you like, and there you would just say, right, A company, off you go, or B company, something like that. You wouldn't really worry about whether Muslim or Hindu. And they did their job very well. I think the English post-1900 didn't take as much interest as they should have done in India. What I mean by that is that in the 1800s and the 1700s, a lot of Englishmen got to really know the Indians, their background, their religions, and in fact it was an Englishman who reintroduced Sanskrit. It was only the priests who used it then, and there's an Englishman who learnt it and wrote up the dictionary for it and everything. You know, they really got into India, I think on the grounds of the slowness of travel those days, they thought, well, I won't get home very often, this is going to be my home, so I'll jolly well get to know it. Whereas there was, I think underneath, with our people, and now I'm talking of the regulars pre-war, there was always a feeling that I will be serving 25 years and then I will go home. I'm on a temporary basis, you know, and nobody would talk about settling in India. If you did, you were a bit odd, there was something funny about you. Therefore, I think they didn't take the interest in India they should have done. So much more could have been studied, the religions, the languages, the politics. We had some who were very good at it and liked it and studied it, but I think it should have been much, much more common than it was. Now, that's easy for me to say now, looking back on things. Whether I would have done it, I don't know. I think I might have done, because I, being a loner and curious, I always wanted to get out and see the other side. Excuse me.
And you mentioned earlier the increase in Indian officers.
The
increase in Indian officers coming into the officer corps. Did that have, what sort of effect did that have on how the troops would relate to the officers and the effectiveness of
it's
the
possible that at the very, very beginning, and I mean very, very beginning, there may have been the odd feeling of, well, you know, he's just one of us, why should we do it? But no, they were accepted quite normally. They arrived, they with their ranks on their shoulders, and I think on the whole people were pleased probably to see them. Look, our own people are doing it, sort of thing. I know that I can't remember any trouble at all of troops saying that, oh, he's an Indian, we don't want to serve under him. And some of them, like Sultan, I mentioned to you, who's now in Pakistan, I mean, he was tremendously popular with the troops. And that's not because he was from the ruling caste of a very small state, it was just because he was who he was. He was a really charming person.
And would the officers have to be of the same religion?
Or no. No. Any officer could command anything. I think sometimes a colonel might have chosen a bit carefully, but no, normally it was, no, any officer does any job, and that's it.
And how did the Sikhs fit in with the Muslim-Hindu balance between?
Well, they were one of the one caste regiments. Sikh regiments were all Sikhs. So, in a way, I mean, I suppose they stood out a little differently. I can't really answer that question except to say to you that when the riots came at partition, granted it was the Punjab where the Sikhs live, but they were the most vicious and the most brutal of everybody to the Muslims, you know, the slaughtering and that. But whether that's because they thought their home area was in danger, or whether that was an innate dislike or hate of Muslims, I honestly don't know. But Sikhs are funny people. I heard a story once, I don't know the truth of this at all, that they're very vengeful. And up on the frontier once, one Sikh got to like another Sikh boy of another village, and they probably slept with each other for all I know. Anyhow, I got to like him, and a man from the boy's village quitted his picket, which is bloody dangerous to do, went across to the other picket where this other soldier was and shot him and came back. I cannot vouch for the truth of that, but I heard it on more than one occasion. I never took to the Sikhs very much until I came to this country, when my postmaster was a Sikh and I got to know others, and they found them just like anybody else. So, but apart from that, Muslims and Hindus got on perfectly well, and of course set apart from everybody were the Gurkhas. The Gurkha had an honorary British soldier position. He could go into a British soldier's mess and drink beer. No other Indian was allowed to do that, but the Gurkha was an honorary British soldier. But they were so different, and of course, being a complete foreigner away, coming from Nepal, they did stick to themselves very much. And of course, they were so efficient, they really stood out.
Are you aware of any particular general change in attitude as the Japanese moved through Burma towards the border with India? Was there any shift in how the Indian public as a whole viewed the war?
There was a big political shift, and the INA started, and Subhas Chandra Bose had been very popular in India, although he'd been in Germany, then gone to Japan and then got killed. So the free India and get rid of the British and all that increased quite a lot. I mean, we did have a lot of trouble there. Again, it may have affected one or two military units, but I can't quote anything to you. And I know that when we had to go out on riot control, the Indian troops were just as good as ever. There was, as you know, at the very end of the war, the big Bombay revolt in the Indian Navy, but I can't tell you whether that was political, religious, or what.
On the domestic side, did you have any particular hobbies, off-duty hobbies, while in India?
Well, my hobby was India and the languages, and that I really did like India, and it was something new to me. And then, of course, I didn't have much of a life before the war. I had a year only before the war. And then, of course, once the war came, you did have a lot of work to do, and you had to get cracking on things. But if ever there was a chance to learn a bit about India, that was more of a hobby with me. Apart from that, I don't think people had hobbies except the Victorian one of drawing and painting. Quite a lot of people did that. The Victorian Memsahibs, as you know, were famous for their drawings and paintings, and they were good too. I've seen a lot of them. They were really good. Some of our people liked sketching, would go off sketching. The camera had come into use. One or two went filming, but of course film was difficult to get during the war. I can't think of other specialized hobbies than that. There may have been.
How much contact did you have with your family?
my family at home? Probably a monthly letter to my mother, and not very much to my sister, although when I finally came back to this country, she's presented me, and I've got upstairs a file of my letters about that thick, but they dated from when I was really in Australia, no, Pakistan, then Australia, then Korea and so on. They dated more from that time. And then again, mail took a little longer in the war, and usually you were down to one sheet which folded over and stamped and so on. I think that was an individual thing. You know, some people wanted to talk a lot to their parents and wrote, and others like me were not all that worried. I never really valued how good and unselfish my mother had been until she was dead, and I looked back on what I found out she had done, and I never appreciated it. I was a spoilt child, and so probably I didn't write very much.
Moving on to Japan, to what extent were you briefed for a specific role as an occupier, and how you should behave?
Oh, we just had the one thing. What was the word? You know, no mixing.
Fraternizing.
Yeah, no fraternization. Non-fraternization. That was the word, and that covered everything. You were not meant to be interested in anything. You were to do nothing with the Japanese, which of course were where I come up against a brick wall, so went through it. But the only people who mixed with the Japanese. The Americans mixed. They're always like, they were very, very friendly, and the Japanese are quite hurt in Okayama. I know when we came and said, well, why don't the British talk to us? What's wrong? The Americans were very friendly and, you know, came down, looked for the girls and everything. That we were asked a number of times. I think a number went in thinking these bloody Japs, they've been terrible and they're appalling, the butchery and everything. But very quickly they saw, well, it wasn't so, and the women were quite good looking, the people were polite, kept out of your way, and this sort of thing. And so there wasn't an awful lot of anti-Japanese feeling. Maybe the odd drunk did something, but I can't remember any actual anti-Japanese things.
Did you have much direct experience with the Americans?
Only with a very small group. You remember I mentioned to you AMGOT, the Allied Military Government. We used to call it the American Military Government. They had a group in every main Ken town, like Okayama Ken. There was a group in Okayama City itself of about 12 or 14, and they technically were the government of the province, of the prefecture. But it was all done through us, if necessary. And their main thing, I think, was the gathering of information, the following up of war criminals, and the general good running of the kenjo, of the prefecture. There weren't any others than that. There was strict boundary line between Okayama, I was on the border, and Himeji, which was the next province up. They were American, we were us, and there was a strict boundary line. I mean, there weren't posts along the boundary and things like that, but you didn't go over into it. Although my opposite number in Osaka, the military police chief there, he invited me over for Thanksgiving Day once more, for 3 days covering Thanksgiving. But quite honestly, most of that was taken up in heavy drinking in his quarters. But one amusing thing is, he said, would you like to come on a black market raid with us? Because there was a terrific black market going on, because the Japanese had nothing. They were really down. I mean, Chio will tell you about the food they had to eat. It was absolutely bare minimum. So, big black market. So he said, well, would you like to come out in the black market raid? Oh, yes, I'll come. You know, anything for a laugh. And we went off. They did it in real American style. About 12 jeeps swooped on an area, you know, real swoop, with horns going and everything else. And the men leapt out and rushed into houses. And they found quite a bit of American occupation money. There was an American occupation money, there was a British occupation money, and there was also the Japanese money. We were only meant to use British money. The Americans were only meant to use American. This was trying to stop black market between all the things. But of course, people use all three if you're necessary. They found a lot of money. They found quite a bit of uniforms, clothing, and other stuff that was being sold, because the Japanese wanted clothes, so there was quite a black market for uniforms. Certain amount of rations. The Americans had terrific rations, so they could flog off food quite easily. And in one house we found a suitcase which was packed, literally packed with wads of 10,000 yen notes, absolutely packed to the top, which we put into the Provost Marshal's jeep. So as we were going off, after it was all over, we were going back towards their office, the Provost Marshal leaned over to the back, and there were three of us in the jeep, him, his number two, and me. And he opened up the thing, and he took out a great big wad of 10,000 yen notes and said to his number two, "Here's a souvenir." Took out another wad to me, "Here's a souvenir." One put in his own pocket and then closed the thing down. I forget how much I had. I now worked it out, and it was the equivalent, I think, of about 300 or 400 pounds in the wad. But it had a sad ending, because I stayed one more day. Then I got the train to come back. And during that night at midnight, the yen was devalued from a 60 to the pound to 1,000 to the pound. So I had just £60. I thought I had about, 200-300. But there was no other connection between the Americans and us that I remember, except in Tokyo, where there was a big honor guard, and which was paraded every day near the palace, and the British had their turn, and New Zealanders had theirs, and Australians had theirs. There was sort of a switch over there. So while the honor guard was up there, they were living with the Americans and so on. But apart from that, there was just the Angot group that I can remember, and no other.